Shalom and welcome again to today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I am your host, Rabbi Richard Address. And in these podcasts, we hope to explore some of the issues that touch on our families, our communities, and ourselves as a result of the revolution in longevity. And you can contact us via our homepage, jewishsacredaging.com, or via our Facebook page, Jewish Sacred Aging on Facebook. And we welcome your comments either on the voicemail icon on our website or to me directly at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. And we welcome with great pleasure now to our Seekers of Meaning podcast, Rabbi Sid Schwartz, author, community activist, senior fellow of Chazon, and the director of Knesia, the Communities of Meaning. Shalom, Sid. Thank you for being a guest here on Jewish Sacred Aging's Seekers of Meaning podcast. How are you doing?
My pleasure, Richard. It's an honor.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Let's get right to one of the main features that we want to talk about. And that is, in just a very short amount of time, you're convening a group of people at the Pearlstone Conference Center outside of Baltimore for the Knesia Communities of Meaning Conference. Can you give us an overview of, first of all, what is Knesia? What do you do and what the purpose of this conference may be?
Sure. In order to explain that, I need to take a step back and talk about the origin of what is called Knesia Communities of Meaning Network. Back in 2016, I published a book called Jewish Megatrends, Charting the Course of the American Jewish Future. And in that book, I profiled the decline of the legacy sector of the organized Jewish community, made up of primarily synagogues, Jewish federations, Jewish community centers, and national membership organizations. With rare exceptions, each of those sectors are in steep decline in terms of membership and scope. But simultaneous to that, there's been a upsurge of innovative, creative thinking and organizing among Jews, many of them younger, creating new models of Jewish community and Jewish identity. So Knesia was essentially the platform to help identify, convene, and build capacity in these six sectors of innovative Jewish life. The six sectors, let me enumerate, were social justice, Jewish learning, Jewish environmentalism or eco-sustainability, new models of Jewish community, spiritual practice, and arts and culture. We've been gathering these folks since 2016, and our network now numbers about 300 nationwide. And this November, our organizing principle is that we're inviting into our gathering five different affinity tracks that represent specific approaches to engaging Jews at different stages of life. Those tracks include a boomer engagement track, which of the five has actually turned out to be the most popular, a track on new spiritual communities, think synagogues that don't call themselves synagogues, but doing many of the same things, next generation engagement, Jewish learning and spirituality, and finally, a track called Rising Tide, which is a small group of new paradigm mikvahot, ritual baths, which 20, 30 years ago would have been seen as retrograde, not at all in the feminist spirit. But the mikvahot that are being created today are actually as progressive as they come, helping people mark all kinds of life transitions from not only birth or conversion or marriage, but also gender transition and the like. So those groups are going to come together under our umbrella of Knesia to essentially help each of them network with like-minded organizations, leaders and entrepreneurs, and also for us to do a lot of skill training and building among these folks who are creating these new models of Jewish life and learning.
So, it's fascinating because as I go around North America and doing these workshops and programs and congregations and organizations, what the analysis, especially dealing with boomers that you're outlining, I see this all the time. And in truth, this conference I was just at, sponsored by the Methodist, the United Church in Canada, that just dealt with the shifts in that denomination in the province of Ontario very, very much reflects, as you know, as the Putnam book many years ago, Bowling Alone, reflected the beginning of this change. What's in your, and you've written about this not only in Jewish Megatrends, but the other book, Finding a Spiritual Home. Why is this happening? Why are these legacy organizations beginning to wither, or at least stagnate, if not wither, but definitely stagnate with rare exceptions? And yet, I find in many of the boomer groups that I work with, tremendous energy, excitement, innovation. The whole workshop we do on new rituals really is emerging from baby boomers and longevity. What's going on, Sid? What's happening now?
Well, let me try and go big picture. We have to understand that the American Jewish community was not atypical to the American experience, served the needs of an ethnic immigrant community that came to this country late 19th century, early 20th century. And for several generations, it functioned very much as the kind of way that Jews integrated into American life was through their own ethnic immigrant lens. And that worked actually even past the first generation of immigrants, even to the next generation. But if you look at what drove the organizing principle of American Jewish life for much of the 20th century, till late in the 20th, I would argue, was a ethos of ethnic survivalism. So on one level, there was a sense of, we're still not fully welcomed here. There's still barriers to entry for us. We need to fight anti-Semitism. Remembering the Holocaust was a very big feature of Jewish life. With the rise of the State of Israel, the defense of Israel became a large communal agenda item. And, you know, what we've seen, not only with Jews, but with every immigrant group, oftentimes it's the need to have protection against what is seen as a not totally hospitable host culture that drives ethnic solidarity. That worked until, I would argue, late into the 20th century. But if you take a lot of those principles and you test them against what I've called, some of my writing, the New American Jew, and I want to add parenthetically here, but importantly, that I'm not only talking about millennials. I'm going to say more about this because I know you focused a lot on boomers. But it's not just millennials, although it may, the trends and the attitudes probably are more obvious among millennials, but I would say it cuts across several generations. So if you take the principles of ethnic survivalism, defense against anti-Semitism, support for Israel, they don't resonate in the same way in the early 21st century as they did for much of the 20th century. And so many Jews are starting to distance themselves from the established American Jewish organizations, which no longer represent their core values. Now, I've argued, in contrast to many demographers and prognosticators who predict that the declining membership rates at major Jewish organizations is a sign of decline, I've argued that actually something else is happening. I don't buy the decline argument at all. In fact, I would argue that the emerging Jewish communities of meaning that we're identifying are actually the eve of a renaissance of Jewish life if we play our cards right. And I've also argued that actually it's not taking a step away from Jewish identity. It's simply Jewish identity recast. And so we've talked about the way that new Jewish organizations and communities will attract the new American Jew is not by being more assimilationist, not by being more American, but by actually raising up some core principles or themes of Judaism. And the five that I talk about are Kedusha, living lives of sacred purpose, Chochmah, the pursuit of Jewish wisdom, Kehilah, the development of true community, not just putting your check down and being a member somewhere, but a community where people care about you, you care about it, and there's a common commitment to a shared mission. And Tzedek, the pursuit of justice in our society and in the world. Finally, the fifth sector is Yetzirah, the ability to raise up our creative potential in all kinds of arts, music, drama, literature, and the like. Each of these themes are central to Judaism. And the good news is that Jews love to see that their tradition actually provides these portals of entry, doorways in to living lives of meaning in a Jewish way. When we identify these new communities of meaning, we usually have them identify themselves by one of those sectors that I just enumerated. And a lot of the work we do is to have the sectors learn from each other. So typically a group that comes in that's singularly focused on social justice sits together or learns from another emerging community of meaning that might be focused on Jewish learning or spiritual practice. And each has a chance to influence the other. The social justice group, really into organizing, might say, let's find a way to incorporate more Jewish learning into our work or spiritual practice. And conversely, the spiritual practice group or the Jewish learning group might say, we need to find a way to be a bit more outward focused and not simply focusing on ourselves. So I think part of what's unique about the social economy we're living in now in America is that as opposed to having large organizations like synagogues or JCCs that do a little bit of everything and are, if you will, a Walmart of Jewish life, the organizations that we're identifying, typical of the social economy, are niche. They are boutique organizations doing one thing very, very well. The founder usually is passionate about that one thing. The question is, how are they going to essentially conduct their work and see that other aspects of Jewish life also might add value to the way they conduct their organizational or community life?
I mean, the concept of innovation, I had a professor at the Hebrew Union College, Dr. Rifkin of blessed memory, who really restructured a lot of Jewish history around the concept. There was a dialectic model of preservation, adaptation, and innovation. And I teach, and my observation is, as you are writing in the New American Judaism and Jack Wertheimer and his new book on that, the idea that we really are right now in America at the birth of an innovative, a new chapter in Jewish innovation. And I really believe that, but the culture or the establishment seems to fight that. Why, am I mistaken on that? Are these, as you call them, legacy institutions? Do you find some sense of resistance about this, that we are entering an innovation age in American Judaism?
Well, resistance is kind of the default posture of organizations that are finding themselves losing market share. I think there's another way, and I'll get to that in a moment, but let me just build out on it because it is quite a prominent phenomenon, and it doesn't only happen in Jewish life. Let's use, for example, one of the hot button issues in Jewish life today is Israel, of course. There's a very large network of organizations that pay attention to Israel's survival, Israel advocacy, AIPAC being the largest of them, but there are literally dozens of such organizations. Now, there's a changing view among many American Jews about Israel today, and a lot of Jews who love Israel and who would even call themselves Zionists have many issues with the way that Israel has been conducting both its domestic policy and its foreign policy, not just towards the peace process and Palestinians, but in terms of internally on issues of religious pluralism and things like that. The Jewish community is so anxious, has so much anxiety about Israel's future, that they've created an environment where someone speaking out to be critical of anything about Israel has them branded as anti-Israel. And if they're not Jewish, they're called anti-Semitic. We start slinging these labels at left and right. And what I find is, especially among younger Jews, is that because they are free thinkers, they're not prepared to toe the line in a way that perhaps a previous generation towed the line, and they perhaps don't see Israel as quite as threatened as a previous generation, when they see a Jewish community that is creating all kinds of blackballing and marginalizing and ostracizing of Jews who have a critical opinion, they simply walk away. It's been called, in the literature around Israel, it's been called the the detachment phenomenon, that this is not a matter of being pro or anti-Israel. It's a matter that for more and more Jews, Israel slash Zionism is not even in the equation any longer around Jewish identity. Now, for me, growing up in the 60s and 70s, that would have been unheard of. Zionism in Israel was central to my identity. But now I'm meeting Jews who are very committed to Jewish life, who don't give much of a thought at all to Israel or Zionism. And that is a casualty of the defensive posture of the organized Jewish community that has tried to hold the line, albeit unsuccessfully. Now, the same would be true about synagogues, by the way. Synagogues, most of whom, mainstream synagogues, most of whom are losing membership numbers, see the rise of new models of whether there's an independent minyan or Jews organizing around social justice or around Jewish learning, and who don't set foot in their synagogues, you know, will, you know, not look at the phenomenon in a very hospitable and friendly way. They see them as competitors. They'll say, you know, again, typical, you know, a rabbi or a lay leader of a synagogue will say, these Jews should be doing it in our building. They should join our synagogue and pay membership dues here because we are the main retail outlet of Judaism around the country. So synagogues, seeing themselves, and perhaps correctly, as the retail outlet of American Jewish life in communities all across America, they see these different models of that draw Jews in around Jewish learning or social justice or spiritual practice, and they think to themselves, why aren't they doing it in our building? Why aren't they paying dues and supporting us? We are the main Jewish outlet in our community. But because we're not a papal hierarchy, nobody's asking the opinion of younger Jews whether they feel that synagogues are the proper central address of Jewish life. They follow their heart. They follow their passion. Now, I think there is another way. And part of what we're doing within Knesa is we are engaging the organized Jewish community to say, you need to see this phenomenon of emerging Jewish communities of meaning as an amazing opportunity. You have things that they need, and they have things that you need. Let me be really straight about it. Most of the emerging communities of meaning we're finding are resource poor, they're short on money, and they also tend to be somewhat unsophisticated around organizational development. Just because you're passionate about a given pursuit of Jewish life, it doesn't mean you can build an organization that can survive into year 3, 5, 7, and 10. It seems to me that the failure rate of new nonprofits is at least as high as new businesses, which fail at a very high rate, 2 out of 3, from what I understand. So part of what we're doing is to say, look, there could be partnerships created between these new models of Jewish community and the established communities. And the reason it's a win-win for both parties is that these emerging communities of meaning are attracting precisely the Jews that the mainstream organizations can no longer attract. So if there's a sharing of resources, a sharing of organizational know-how, and a coming together of new approaches to Jewish life that are more appealing to these new American Jews than perhaps the legacy organizations can provide, that seems to me to be a marriage made in heaven, if you'll excuse the expression.
We're speaking with Rabbi Sid Schwartz, a director of Knesa, Communities of Meaning, senior fellow of Chazon. Sid, in case somebody wants to contact you or get some more information about your work, what's the contact information, website? Where would somebody go?
Well, the website for Knesa is knesa.org, K-E-N-I-S-S-A. I would point people in the direction of, on our website, we're now putting together a national mapping project, a database of all these organizations I mentioned earlier that were close to 300 now. So I'd encourage people who are in a group that is organizing on its own, perhaps, you know, early stages, they may not have a staff, certainly probably don't have a building, but working in one of the sectors I mentioned earlier, you can go right on our website, knesa.org. Go to the tab that says National Mapping Project and register yourself. You'll be contacted by my staff. You'll be given a slightly longer intake form so we can know more about you, and you'll become part of this database. I will say that we're now doing some close work with some national Jewish organizations that are very interested in building the bridges and the kind of partnerships that I spoke to a little bit earlier. So that would be a great way for people to become part of our Knesset network. And furthermore, once you're on our database, it's that database we use to invite people to our March consultation, which happens once a year. We invite essentially 50 leaders of these new communities of meaning to come together and to become part of our network. So if you want to become a part of the network, that's the way in.
And do you, you're located in the district area, the Washington, D.C. area, correct?
Well, I personally live in outside of Washington, D.C., but Knesset is a national project. Chazon is our fiscal sponsor. They're based in New York, and they have offices on the West Coast and in Detroit as well. So locale these days is an old-fashioned concept. Our retreats are move around as well.
Correct. But the point is that if there's no, for example, do you organize the collection of these new emerging communities on a regional or local level, or is it just basically the opportunity once a year at this conference for them to meet?
Well, that's a great question. And I should say that we have work going on year round. Every year coming out of our March consultation, the members of the network create communities of practice, which meet on a regular basis throughout the year. That too happens virtually because people are all over North America, including Canada. So we have communities of practice on everything from fundraising to building staff to organizational culture to an executive director's community of practice. And they meet on a regular basis where they share their challenges and their success stories. You know, it's having founded several organizations, I know a lot about the loneliness of the entrepreneur. Now, you work around the clock to build something, and then, but you feel very lonely in the pursuit, and you're not always in a logical professional network. And Knesset is creating that network for these young Jewish innovators. And if people are in that category, it's not only the national conferences where they can come together, but year-round, our communities of practice have been a really important source of support for these entrepreneurs.
Let me ask you a question that has about a dichotomy that I keep running into as I travel and do some work with my Jewish sacred aging stuff, and that is, do you see a difference now in this emerging new American Judaism between the concept of membership and the idea of belonging?
Totally. Really important. And I would say, you know, I've seen a lot of organizing happening in the Jewish world that essentially seeing that younger Jews, millennials in particular, are not joiners, they've kind of cast that to the wind. But I think we need to make a distinction. You use the word belonging. I want to make a distinction between membership in the classic sense of paying dues to be on someone's membership rolls, which is certainly out of fashion, primarily because most of those institutions essentially engage people in a transactional relationship. So I pay X amount of dollars to synagogue X, Y, or Z, and they in turn give me an array of goods and services which I believe I need. That typifies the relationship between most of the legacy organizations, same with JCCs, by the way, same with federations who want your annual campaign dollar. Same for membership organizations like Hadassah or B'nai B'rith. This is transactional relationship. And we know that that business model is failing. It's not working in the next generation. But before we throw the baby out with the bathwater, I want to argue that precisely because of the acceleration of the pace of life happening in the 21st century, and technology is at the root of the accelerated pace, many of us can't even keep up any longer, there is a greater need for community today than ever before. Now, I have to loop back here and say community is one of the most overused words in the English lexicon. And unfortunately, it has cheapened the word. When we talk about communities of meaning, we talk about, I like to use the term, covenantal communities. Communities that, because many synagogues and JCCs that have membership Jews will use the term community, but it's a misuse of the term, in my view. When I talk about a covenantal community, I believe that within a community, it means that individuals have a commitment to one another. And in turn, the people in the community have a shared sense of mission about what they're trying to work towards. I define communities of meaning as networks of individuals that are inspired by an idea or a practice that enriches their lives and or significantly improves conditions in the world for others. That's a very different kind of community than simply sending your dues into a synagogue and showing up two or three times a year because you like to attend Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur services. I think all over the place, in every sector we've worked in, we're finding a deep hunger for community, even greater than was the case a generation back. I'd say the need for community is greater than it was a generation ago, not less than. And so before we essentially throw out the membership model, I think the question I want to challenge the community with, both established organizations and new organizations, is to say, before you ask, before you put out a membership deal to get people to join your group, ask the question about how you will weave a network of interdependence among the people you are serving. How you make their engagement with your organization or your community something that helps them fulfill their own human potential. How will it advance human flourishing? If you answer those questions first, then the business models will follow. But if you first focus on how much can we charge for the goods and services we provide, it's a non-starter. You're dead on arrival, DOA. It's a different set of questions. And I think those organizations that are actually asking those meaning and belonging questions are actually thriving because people are desperate for it.
Yeah, my work, and as I go around this desire, almost demand, I'd say some places demand for community, especially in boomers, I think a lot of it has to do with what we have seen with our own parents and the impact, one of the impacts of longevity and the fear of being, you know, livado, of being alone. And as the circles of relationships contract as we age, the idea that the relationships that we have, I call this my theology of relationships, the relationships that we had and thus community become even more important. And I see this all over. It's very, very powerful. That's why I wanted to ask your opinion on that membership, because so many places you come in, you write a check and you're a member, but it doesn't mean anything more than your own membership role. And that's a real, you know, I see that. I'm agreeing with that. I see that as a major issue. There's one other issue. Well, there's many other issues before we start running out of time, that I want to poke your brain a little bit as one rabbi to another rabbi. This emerging communities, the change, the evolution, the dynamism, is it being matched with a theological innovation? Because in a lot of these conversations that I've had, the sense of, to put it bluntly, where God is in all this seems to be just, it's more organizational than theological. And I'm struggling with where is that role of the sacred and the theological foundation for all this is. Where do you see this changing as part of your new American Judaism?
Okay, I appreciate the question. So in regard to theology and God, I would say that there are there's more than one approach. Meaning, can I identify people in our network who have a deep hunger for God and longing for God and want to talk theology? For sure. Does that represent the majority of the phenomenon? No, it doesn't. So I don't think we can make one statement about the whole phenomenon. In fact, part of my learning curve in the first couple of years of building the Knesset network is that I was using the term early on, spiritual communities, as an umbrella for all the phenomenon that I was seeing in terms of communities of meaning. I used spiritual community before I used the term community of meaning. And I got some pushback because we found that many of the folks organizing new models of Jewish identity and Jewish life were relating to Judaism as a culture. They didn't want any part of theology or God or ritual or liturgy or services. It's not where they were at, but they were very passionate about the wisdom of Judaism, its orientation towards bringing greater justice in the world to vulnerable populations and the like. And so there was pushback against my term spiritual community. So now we came up with the term communities of meaning, which tends to work across the spectrum, whether they are highly secular and cultural or highly religious, observant, and thirsting for God. Communities of meaning has worked as an umbrella term. And within that network, we have subsets of groups that are talk about spiritual practice or spiritual community or about God, and those, you know, who are quite apart from that phenomenon. So, you know, similar to other parts of our society today, we are having a, it's hard to find a common middle ground where people share all the same assumptions, all the same behaviors, all the same attitudes and beliefs. That's hard in politics today, and it's true for the religious spiritual path. Keep in mind that when I mentioned earlier the themes that we work with the Kedusha, one of them is Kedusha. Here again, my definition of Kedusha is not your standard definition in most Jewish places. If you ask certainly most rabbis, they would define Kedusha as holiness. And I know that that's probably the first translation in a Hebrew-English dictionary. But in the network of people I work with, holiness may fly, but also may be a turnoff to people. So we call Kedusha, the way we define it, is living lives of sacred purpose. Now, I would argue that even my most secular network member would say that they have a strong sense of Kedusha in that they're finding a way to live their lives with sacred purpose. And they may never want to utter the G word because it's simply not who they are. But I would argue that if we have a broad enough framework for our theology today, we not get hung up on the proper noun God and ask how do Jews and others find ways to live lives of sacred purpose.
Do you see a retreat from organized worship?
I see a retreat from formulaic worship. I've been to places, because of the kind of work I do, I do a lot of work with rabbis, having them rethink their worship services, rethink what it means to be a spiritual community. And I've seen places that have created ecstatic, joyful, musical gatherings, which at its heart is worship. But I think if you go to many synagogues in America of every denominational stripe, no one denomination owns takes all the fault for this. You don't see that kind of worship. It's very formulaic. It's highly choreographed. There's no room for the prayers. I'm not talking about the prayers. The people who are trying to pray, the people who are trying to bring something into their hearts and souls, they have things to share. If you create a top-down worship service where people are essentially turned to spectators who turn the pages at the rabbi's behest, you're not generating spirituality. You're simply creating a kind of an autopilot form of prayer, which most of Chazal, most of the sages of our tradition criticized even back in the rabbinic period. Mm-hmm.
So in conclusion, before we have to leave, because we're starting to run out of time, given your perspective, your work, if you're facing a group of Jewish people right now, Jewish leaders, what's your impression of the next, where do you think we're going in these next 5-10 years? Be the prophet.
Well, prophets are also called fools, so I'm not sure I'm gonna take that title from you, Rich.
Well,
but I would say the following. I think that we have a tremendous opportunity here. I have to say that in the past 3 years, my work in convening these leaders, these entrepreneurs, these innovators of emerging Jewish communities of meaning has been incredibly exciting. And I've been working in the Jewish community for close to 40 years now. I go to a lot of conventions. I see a lot of committed Jewish professionals, rabbis and others, but nothing compares to the level of creativity and passion that I found in these kind of surprising leaders who we're finding in our Kinesis network. So that makes me very optimistic. Now, with that said, I'm the first to say, and people in my network would say as well, that there are challenges into making these communities into thriving organizations that can survive 5, 10, and more years. The jury is out on that. My hope is, and the work that I'm doing now, is to try and get major Jewish foundations that have a lot of resources, major Jewish community organizations like the Federation System and synagogues, to pay more attention to the phenomenon and to find ways to build partnerships which will be win-wins for both sides. And I would say that the good news here is I am more optimistic today than I was 3 years ago, because with the growth of our network, I did not even know how deep the network was. When I wrote my book, Jewish Megatrends, I talked about a dozen and a half such organizations, and now we're at 300. And we've seen in person close to that number as well, coming to our conferences. So seeing how deep the pool is, the organized Jewish community is sitting up and taking notice now in a way that they weren't 3 and 4 years ago. And that's good news. So it's hard not to be optimistic. I'm bullish. I would say buy. It is not time to sell. And in any case, you know, we who are engaged with Jewish life, we who believe in the power of Judaism to create a more meaningful personal life and a brighter future for society, for the world, not only should we not throw in the towel, we need to double down now, because things are moving in directions that are very exciting.
Real fast follow-up. Do you think you can go to the GA, the Federation conventions, and ask each federation in North America to create a incubator line in their allocations to fund local incubator, startup, new emerging communities? Do you think that's possible?
Well, I can answer that question in a way that is not even speculative. About 3 weeks ago, the Jewish Federation of North America hosted a webinar with me talking about Knesset. And in working with one of the vice president for education and engagement, then working on the North American national level, we hoped we would get maybe a dozen folks signing up. We had over 40 people signed up from every major federation in the country with tremendous interest in continuing meeting and talking. So I think we're moving in that direction. A handful of federations have done and created these kind of incubators. I think the Federation system is looking for ways in to engage this next generation. And that includes underengaged people like boomers, by the way. I think that your work has been so important in this regard. I think boomers have been much neglected. There's all this head over heels excitement about millennials, but I think boomers represent another and very important population for a vibrant Jewish future. But on all levels, the federations need to find ways to pull in the underengaged. And they are starting to pay attention now, which is one of the reasons why I'm so bullish.
And the website again is?
Kinesset.org, K-E-N-I-S-S-A. And I should say that the word Kinesset means entranceway, a pathway, a door in. And we call it that because the portals that we've talked about are actually doorways into Jewish life that otherwise might have been closed had it not been for this emergent phenomenon that we're documenting and working with.
Rabbi Sid Schwartz, author, community activist, director of Knesset, the Communities of Meeting, and senior fellow of Chazon. Thank you very much, Sid, for really this broad-based approach and giving us an opportunity to look at those pathways. And I look forward to seeing you at the conference. And thank you for all your great work and continued success and good health as you move forward. Thank you very much. Take care.
My pleasure, Richard. It's been an honor.
Thank you. To all of you, thank you again for joining us on today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. And a reminder that we welcome comments and contact at our homepage, jewishsacredaging.com, or to me at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. And we invite you to visit our Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. Seekers of Meaning is produced by Steve Lubetkin and recorded at the studios of Lubetkin Global Media here in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Thank you again for joining us, and we look forward to greeting you on the next Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. Thank you, and shalom.